Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hello, podcast listeners. This is a special weekend Brian Lehrer Show podcast. We've compiled a few of the conversations we had this week about economic mobility in America in 2013. All this week, we talked about the societal factors that lead to someone being able to move up the income ladder, the role of government and family, and got tips on how to survive on a low income. So here they are in one podcast. Thanks for listening. And, of course, tune in live every weekday at 10 a.m. to WNYC for more Brian Lehrer Show news and conversation. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we'll begin this hour with a call-in on something that Britain's baby king won't have to worry about, upward mobility. How did you rise up from poverty to the middle class? Tell us your story, 212-433-WNYC. And I ask because of the big new study just released, done at Harvard and elsewhere, of upward mobility, one of the most important economic measures, so tied to the American dream. In old Europe, there was no upward mobility. Class was a definer for life. If you were Caden Williams' baby, no problem. If you were a poor laborer's kid, big problem. The United States was founded in part as a reaction to that. But we've had a tougher time with upward mobility and concentration of wealth in recent decades, a tougher time than many countries in Europe, in fact. But now comes this study that the Times says is based on millions of anonymous earnings records, a huge study, and it finds upward mobility is much more likely in some cities in the United States than others. New York actually is near the top, along with Boston, Salt Lake City, Pittsburgh, and Seattle. If you're born in the bottom 20% in New York, you wind up on average around the 40th percentile. Not bad compared to some of the really low mobility places like Chicago, Atlanta, and Detroit. Not that there isn't a lot better that New York could be or that it hasn't been getting worse in recent years. But if you grew up poor but are now middle class, call in and tell us your story. How did you get there? What personal factors and what outside factors do you think made that possible? You know, if you think you're Horatio Alger pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, where did you get your bootstraps? What social conditions were your bootstraps to pull yourself up by, in addition to whatever you did yourself? The study found, and it's so fascinating if it actually pans out to be true, that certain social conditions are most correlated with people's upward mobility. Good public transit, as we talked about last hour. How about that? So you can get to jobs outside your neighborhood without much money. Also, good public schools. No surprise there. Also, economic integration. If you lived in an isolated island of poverty with only other poor people around, much harder. The article used Atlanta as an example of a metro area where there are vast neighborhoods full of poor housing, less integrated by economics than New York. Family structure, two parents matter on average, or a little more precisely, as the article put it, living in areas with more two-parent families seems to correlate with a poor kid's chances of growing up to be middle class. So fascinating findings, and I wonder if your stories have correlates to any of these factors out there, in addition to whatever was going on in your own life with your own immediate family or yourself. If you grew up poor but are now middle class, call in and tell us your story. How did you get there? 212-433-WNYC. Tammy in Bedford-Stuyvesant, you're up first. Thank you so much for calling, Tammy. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
So tell us, where'd you grow up? What was it like?
I grew up in Long Island City in Queensbridge Houses, actually.
Uh-huh.
And I had all of those so-called strikes against me that you just mentioned, a single-parent home. My mother raised my sister and I by herself. There were a lot of people in poverty around us, but there were also lots of hardworking people around us in the neighborhood. People think that everyone in the projects is super poor. Yes, we were poor, but everyone worked hard, and I saw that. One of the things, I think one major factor that helped me get to middle classdom, is that my mother encouraged me to be practical.
Mm-hmm.
And I always managed to find a job when I was in high school, starting from 14, actually.
How about the people around you? Would you say a lot of other kids from your generation in Queensbridge houses have grown up to be middle class, and there was something that you can hook to that community, or maybe the location of that community within the city, and it's not hard to get on public transit from Long Island City, or I don't know what, or the culture, you know, of practicality and hard work that you were talking about being exposed to? How'd your peers do?
I actually am not in touch with a lot of people that I grew up with, unfortunately, and I hope that they're doing well. But I will say, for me personally, I remember when the Q train at 21st Street Queensbridge opened up, mm-hmm. when the MTA put a stop there. And I was able to get out of the neighborhood and explore and go find a job, go to schools outside of the neighborhood, and just get around easier.
That's so interesting on the transit level and on the personal level. Tammy, thank you so much, and good luck to you. Ginger in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ginger. Ginger, can you hear me? Yeah, now
yes,
I can hear you.
Yes, I can hear you perfectly.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Bushwick, Brooklyn in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, at the time, as you can imagine, one of the lowest income poor, quite frankly, communities in the city at a time when the city was burning.
And today?
Today I live in Bed-Stuy, quite an interesting sort of just across the other side of Broadway. But the story is, essentially, I went to one of the prep schools here in the independent schools, the Dalton School in New York, and then from there went on to Harvard and then pretty much did the predictable thing. And now, with my husband and I consider ourselves fairly middle class.
How'd you wind up at Dalton from Bushwick? Because that's not a usual, typical route.
Yeah. in addition to, like, the previous caller, I grew up in a single-parent family. My mom is an immigrant from Central America. She spoke zero English. But essentially, how I got to Dalton is I was a fairly ambitious kid. Just really liked sort of school, and I was tracked. I was tracked in elementary school. I went to the local neighborhood school in Bushwick, but was in the track classes. And then I went to a magnet school that was started by a woman who, an African-American woman, who went to UPenn and wanted to create essentially something with opportunity for students. And then at that magnet school, I was in a track class, excuse me, classes within that magnet school, and there was a teacher there who identified me essentially as well as a couple of other students who mm-hmm. could apply to private schools. And so that's how I applied and eventually got to Dalton.
And Ginger, I'm going to have to go because the line is breaking up pretty badly, but thank you and good luck to you. And Michelle in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I'm going to be very quick. I attribute my ability to now be a professional. It really goes back to my grandparents. They migrated here from Jamaica, the earliest one in the 1920s. And I started my life really in the South Bronx. That's where my parents lived. My grandparents came here. They lived in Harlem. My grandmother was a domestic and my grandfather was a janitor. But they also always wanted to have their own. So they did their own businesses at home. My grandfather fixed televisions and radios, and my grandmother was a dressmaker. And they pushed us to be educated. You know, my mother and father, we started out with them together. We lived in the South Bronx. Mm-hmm. And my parents in the 70s bought a house in the Bronx. But now I live in my grandmother's building.
Wow.
In Harlem, because throughout the years when Harlem was still pretty much redlined, you didn't have any banks and so on, my grandmother paid off her mortgage on her house. And my mother struggled to keep it, raising four kids. My parents divorced. And I, after college, went there to take care of my grandmother with my mom, and I stayed there. And I live there now because of their efforts. I can relate to your previous caller. I went to public high school, public elementary school, high schools that were tracked, and the push then was to be in college-bound programs, and that helped me a lot. I went to CUNY. I got my bachelor's at Hunter, and later on, through student loans and working, I too worked as early as 14, got working papers. Yeah. I traveled on the subway. Mm. Going to Hunter, I took three trains every morning and three trains every evening to get back uptown to the Bronx. But family, we pushed for education. My grandparents and my mother pushed for us to get an education.
It's so classic, isn't it? Family, education, mass transit, even though it was three trains, to get you somewhere without having to own a car or have more money to get around.
Absolutely. And the transit system was monumental to our lives. I grew up with family and friends. When we left high school in the years when there was a push to spread students out to different schools based on their interests. And, you know, we lived in a very close-knit West Indian community, but we were going to school all over the city. I was in Manhattan. My neighbors were going to Brooklyn Tech and going to the technical schools all over the city, mm-hmm. and we were very much reliant.
Michelle, thank you so much for calling, and good luck to you. Let's go to Alan in Old Tappan. You're at WNYC. Hi, Alan.
How you doing, Brian?
Good.
I grew up in the Bronx as well, over near Van Cortlandt Park, and it was really a time that you could dream. I could remember I was on Orchard Beach with my mother and with my two brothers, and I looked out and I saw a yacht out there, and I told my mother I wanted one. And she looked at me and she said, if you work hard, you go to school, you'll do well, and you'll buy one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that you would find it very hard to say that to your children today.
What else do you think were factors for you? So your mother told you, she gave you the ethic of hard work paying off.
Right. I think that the education system was very different. I went to Dewey Clinton High School. I graduated in 1961, and then I went on to college, Philly Dickinson. And in my high school, they actually separated the student body into three parts. They had the regular students, they had honor and scholarship, and you didn't stay within that group in all your studies. You, depending on what your level was in math or in science or in English, and the teachers actually worked with the students that were in the regular classes to get them to move forward so that you can go to different mm-hmm. levels.
That's good.
And everything was more open. And, you know, what I go back to is when they broke up all the conglomerates and everything. Everything in business seems to be consolidated. I got to say that I'm really fortunate. I made it into the 1%, not even into the middle class.
So you got that? You got that yacht?
No, I didn't. But I got a couple of Ferraris, four Bentleys, and a Lamborghini. I had no interest in boats.
Alan, thank you. Thank you very, very much for sharing your story. I appreciate it. We're taking your stories of upward mobility. If you grew up poor but made it to the middle class, how did you do it? What did it have to do with the people around you? What did it have to do with the social conditions? Some of the things in this new big study of different cities, upward mobility, New York ranks pretty well because of less social isolation and physical isolation of poor people compared to places like Atlanta and Chicago and Detroit. 212-433-WNYC. And Catherine in Manhattan, you're on the air. Hi, Catherine.
Brian, I grew up in public housing in Darien, Connecticut, and that's a big part of what I attribute to being able to make it into the middle class. You know, my parents, I don't know if they were so ambitious, they were more hardworking. They both grew up in real poverty, and they were able to get public housing in Darien, Connecticut, which, as you might know, is one of the richest suburbs in the area. And so I went to just a regular public school, but I was surrounded by extremely wealthy people, extremely ambitious, and ambitious people. And the assumption was for all of us students that we were going to college, you know, just because of the environment I was in. And I was I just really attribute to my whole understanding of myself as having been able to be in that environment. So the significant thing to me is that the public housing that I grew up in was in a rich
yes.
area.
So the high school you went to was a public high yeah. school. It was your neighborhood-zoned high school, which just happened
exactly.
to include rich people and poor people.
Yeah, well, not many poor people, you know.
Yeah.
The public housing was basically a block of actual houses. We weren't mm-hmm. in there was an apartment building there, but it was small houses, which, by the way, were just torn down last year. So
really?
I'm very upset.
Is there any more public housing in Darien that you know
you
of?
You know, I've wanted to go back and invest. I think there are a few of the houses left, but I don't know if Darien is making up for. I don't think so. They're building these huge, you know, McMansions there, so it's very upsetting to me because I mean, my parents, as I say, were really hardworking, and so I got that ethic from them. But I just saw myself as obviously going to college. I didn't even think of myself as poor because I lived in this really rich area, and I went to this really wealthy high school because it was a local public high school. And I just thought it was so important for just having my view of myself.
And this is the essence, I think, of what that study found. One of the things that they said in particular as, you know, a particular attribute of cities that have more upward mobility is that poor families don't live only among other poor families. And so if you can disperse pockets of poverty and not have them become big zones of poverty, then more people are going to have experiences like yours, and more people are going to have that much more likelihood of being able to move up. But of course, there are such political obstacles to that. They've tried these experiments in a few cities and have found pretty good results. But then when they tried to replicate it in the 90s, widespread basis in America, there was so much political resistance because every middle-class neighborhood says, not in my backyard with those poor people who are going to come in with their crime.
Yeah, I know. And it's hurtful to me to know that people think that way, because my little neighborhood of public housing was just, you know, just another neighborhood. I mean, we were poorer, but otherwise we weren't any different than the other kids. And as I said, I wasn't even cognizant of being poor. I knew that my house was smaller.
But didn't you have less stuff than the other kids who would go to school?
I'm sorry, less stuff?
Less stuff?
Yeah, well, my mom was a really cheap person, so I actually attributed a lot of my, she was very frugal, and I'm grateful for it, because she was able to buy a small house eventually in Darien, which then was sold. And now, actually, I'm in my new apartment right now. I just bought a place in Manhattan, partly because of my mom's frugality. And being in Darien, she was able to scoop up a house there really inexpensively.
I'm going to leave it there. And
thanks, Brian.
I appreciate all you told us, and good luck to you. Great story with, I think, a really strong central lesson. Let's see. We have time for one more, and I think I'm going to go to the oldest caller who we have on the board, Dorothy in Croton-on-Hudson. Are you 94 years old?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for calling in.
You're welcome. I was going to mention something that nobody seems to have talked about, and that is that the role that unions played in raising people from poverty to less poverty. That's what happened with my father. He came to this country. He and my mother both were immigrants. I'm a first-generation American. My father was lucky to get a job in a factory, in a mill, a shop, I should say.
Where did he come from?
He came from Bessarabia, which was at that time part of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother came from a different part of Russia, and they met in the United States. But the point is, we were accustomed to poverty. Everybody was poor during the Depression. You weren't as ashamed as people are now of being poor, or people have been of being poor. But my father joined the union that covered the kind of work that he did, and that union made it possible for him to earn a living wage. He and my mother were both very concerned that we should have, my brother and I should have an education, and I must say they were more concerned for my brother than for me, because that was what the
at that time,
custom
the
was.
Boys, yeah.
The boy has to be able to earn a living. The girl has to be able to marry. Well, I was lucky to get into a college that didn't charge anything. In fact, right now they're in the process of changing that, and there's a big battle going on.
Oh, so that would be Cooper Union?
Yes. When I went there, there were very, very few charges, and I worked during the day and went to college at night. It seemed like forever, but I got my degree was able to earn a decent living on the strength of what I learned at Cooper Union and what I learned on the job.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's so interesting, and we're going to run out of time, but it's so interesting that you bring up unions because they weren't referenced in the study, at least in the New York Times article on the study that I read through last night. And I wonder, because there are so few private sector workers represented by unions anymore, whether that's declined so much as a factor in raising people up from poverty to the middle class, that it didn't even get mentioned.
Well, but it did at the time when people were poor and raising themselves up, which is maybe go back 30, 40 years, something like that.
At that time, and so maybe there's a lesson there. If people are taking policy conversations out of this big new study, maybe that's one to bring up too. Whatever happened to the unions, if you're looking for private sector as well as public sector, those are the unions that are strong, as you know, are still in the private sector. But to have another conversation about public sector unions. Dorothy, thank you so much for calling us. Good
luck
to you.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks to all of you who called with your stories of making it from growing up poor to middle class as an adult. You can keep posting those stories to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer's show. Look up that article by David Leonhardt in the Times yesterday. I think you'll find that study fascinating. We'll try to have one of the study authors coming up on a subsequent show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now I want to turn back to that study featured on the front page of Monday's New York Times and on our program yesterday that examined the role geography plays in a person's ability to move up the income ladder. The bottom line, location matters because cities are different, and upward mobility is more likely in some metropolitan areas than others. New York was near the top of the list, and yesterday we took your calls on rising from poverty to the middle class. Some of the factors, economic integration helps. Mass transit helps a lot. Education, obviously, and family structure, all cited in this study. Let's find out more. We have one of the study's authors with us to really dig into the wider implications and the details of his work. Nathaniel Hendren is an associate professor of economics at Harvard. Professor Hendren, welcome to WNYC. Thanks a lot for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
How did you do a massive city-to-city-to-city comparison? What was your data set?
So this looks at, as Leonhardt put it, an enormous database of earnings records. So it's a large set of anonymous earnings records that we took a look at across the United States and just analyzed the relationship between parental income and kid outcomes.
And so when you look at the places where economic mobility is happening in greater numbers and the places where it isn't, are there some central common features that you would put first, linking those cities? I mentioned four that jumped out at me, at least from the press coverage: economic integration versus segregation, mass transit, so you can commute out of your neighborhood to get decent jobs, education, and family structure. Are those the right places to start?
Yeah, well, so I think that's that definitely hits on the head the types of correlations we saw across the United States. You know, the other ones to add there are things like we saw variations in tax policy across areas correlated with rates of upward mobility. So areas that had higher local property taxes tended to have higher rates of upward mobility. But that's hard to separate out from, say, the quality of the K-12 education system, because local tax revenue is often funding that. So I think that the broad set of things you just mentioned is exactly in line with the general set of correlations that we find across the United States.
The question of economic integration, I find that one so fascinating. And I think it ran through several of your findings that isolation really keeps people in poverty. If they live in places that have, you know, whole neighborhoods of really poor people, and especially if it's coupled with not so good mass transit, that that really works against getting people out. How central is that?
Yeah, so that was one of the strongest correlations that we found in areas that that do have a greater extent of segregation. And in particular, what really seemed to be most correlated was segregation of poverty. So people that are kind of at the bottom of the income ladder, if they're segregated even from the middle class, that seemed to really be negatively related to upward mobility. And actually, what seemed to matter less was segregation of the affluent. If the rich people were often in an enclave, it wasn't as important as the poor people being separated from the middle class when you looked across the country.
It's a really tough policy to push, as you well know. There were some experiments in the 90s, I think Oak Park in the Chicago area, if I'm thinking of the right neighborhood, where there was, you know, a conscious attempt to put low-income housing in a middle-class neighborhood, not that much low-income housing, but some. And the people who lived in that housing did a lot better than their poor peers who stayed in the concentrated high-poverty areas. Then when they tried to start to replicate that nationally, there was such pushback from whiter or more middle-class communities against having poor people located in their neighborhoods that I think it kind of stopped as a national experiment. Do you get into it on that kind of a policy level?
Well, you know, I think what you're highlighting is a potential policy people could think about. But what I would want to highlight is that our results are really highlighting the areas that have segregation now tend to have lower rates of upward mobility. If these places were to actually try to do something about that segregation, it's not 100% certain that they would be able to actually improve the outcomes. And the reasons are that these issues are really complicated for reasons you were just mentioning. I mean, I think areas that have high rates of segregation also have a lot of other factors that are limiting mobility as well.
In an article on the Atlantic's website evaluating your research, Matthew O'Brien says, the suburbs didn't quite kill the American dream, but a particular type did. That's the low density and racially polarized suburbs that have defined places like Atlanta. Is that an accurate assessment of one of your findings?
So I would say that's a generally accurate assessment of sort of the pattern we were just describing. What really seems to matter is racial segregation and segregation of the bottom portion of the income distribution from the rest of from people in the middle class. And I think when we look across the United States, areas that did have a stronger middle class that where people lived closer to each other, you did see higher rates of upward mobility. Now there are other factors, things that you were mentioning there too, that were actually even stronger could suggest other things are going on. So, for example, the strength of the family structure was highly correlated with rates of upward mobility. So, if you look at areas where there's a high rate of single parents, you see lower rates of upward mobility. Now, what's interesting about that particular correlation is it's not driven by just effects of growing up in a single parent household. You even see kids born to two parent households in areas where there are more single parents tend to have lower rates of upward mobility. And what that suggests to us is that this is really about some characteristic of places that is determining these different rates of mobility.
Did you happen to examine the role of race in all this? When you look at the cities with large African-American populations, Detroit, Jackson, Mississippi, Birmingham, they're near the bottom of your list. Based on your research, what do you make of that?
That's a great question, and yes, we did take a look at the relationship between the spatial pattern that you're seeing on these maps and race, and it is absolutely true that areas that have a higher fraction African American have lower rates of upward mobility. What's interesting is that's true not only on average, but also when you look at the rates of upward mobility for white people in particular. So white people have lower rates of upward mobility in the South, for example. So what that suggests is that perfectly equal interpretation of these findings is that African Americans are more likely to be living in areas that have higher rates or have lower rates of upward mobility, but it doesn't seem to be about the racial composition per se that's driving the differences.
You know, on yesterday's show, we took calls based on your study just to hear people's stories of, from folks who grew up poor but then made it to the middle class, to hear if there were a lot of correlations. And in general, there were. And then our last caller was 94 years old. And she said, you haven't mentioned unions. And when I was a kid and my parents were poor, they had working class manufacturing jobs and they were in unions. And that really helped lift my family out of poverty, she said. I don't see unions in the press write-ups of your study so far as a factor. Is it something that came up?
So that's something that we haven't taken a deep look at, partly because we haven't been able to get the highest quality spatial data that we were looking for. But all of our data is on the web, and actually I would encourage people that have that data to take a look. I think that my guess, I know from talking with people, in, that it does look like there might be a bit of a spatial pattern there. But honestly, I have not personally looked at it. But I think that one important thing to mention here is we've got all our data posted, and we would very much encourage people who have their theories to take a look.
It would be interesting to see, and I guess New York would come into play here as well, because we in New York still have more private sector union representation than most of the rest of the country. So I wonder if that's something that you could ever tease out of the geographical data with respect to New York and other places. But talk to me about New York. Why do you think New York made it to near the top of your list with respect to the possibility of upward mobility?
I mean, that's a great question. And I think, you know, when we talk about the different factors that you were just walking through, it's important to keep in mind that these are things that are explaining the differences across the whole United States. And New York ranks pretty high on some of these factors. You know, it's got a decently sized middle class. It's got, as you were saying, a really nice public transit system. And so it does have characteristics of more upwardly mobile places across the United States. And so, you know, it's always really hard to say this particular factor is driving the success or failure of one of any given particular place. But it certainly has the factors that when one looks across the United States that seem to be correlated with upward mobility.
And it was interesting to see that the areas that fared better than any other are the really sparsely populated parts of the country. So forget cities, the Dakotas, Wyoming, Nebraska. One of the reader comments from the New York Times article says, I grew up in North Dakota. In my small town, rich, poor, and middle class all went to the same schools. I think that matters. Is that comment indicative of why these sparsely populated states happen to do so well in achieving upward mobility?
You know, I think that's a great point, and I think that is exactly what could be going on. I think it's hard to say that it's the integration within schools, the economic integration within schools per se, and that's something that we hope future research will tease out. But I think the general pattern you highlighted is exactly what you see. I mean, one city that struck out to me when you take a look across the map is a place like Dubuque, Iowa, where if you're born to a parent earning less than $25,000 a year in Dubuque, Iowa, you have an equal chance of being anywhere on the income distribution in the United States. And I think that's pretty amazing. I mean, it's one of the only places in the United States that has that.
Do you have plans for future research along these lines? It sounds like you have a massive data set to work with. Are you going to keep digging into it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we hope to answer a lot of the questions that you are asking to really get at why different places are having different experiences with upward mobility. And we'll definitely be looking at this for the years to come.
Any particular, in our last 20 seconds or so, any particular questions that your own findings make you the most curious to look into next?
Well, I think the issues of segregation that you were discussing are first order, and also trying to unpack the differences of family structure across areas and understand what's driving those differences. But I think more generally, we're really trying to get at a handle on what kind of policies, economic policies, people can pursue to really improve upward mobility in areas that currently don't have it.
Harvard economics professor Nathaniel Hendren, one of the authors on the study that you may have seen featured on the front page of Monday's New York Times that examined the role of place in a person's ability to move up the income ladder. Thank you so much for giving us a few minutes.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. As I mentioned, when mayoral candidate Bill Thompson was on, we will be taking calls a little later in the show on the latest Anthony Weiner revelations. People are already posting on our webpage, and go ahead and join that conversation at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Right now, as you may have heard, McDonald's, along with Visa, put out what seems to be an earnest attempt to help its low-wage workers, McDonald's low-wage workers, make personal budgets, to find good percentage of their income to spend on housing and food and health, and even to save a little bit. But it's also been causing a backlash because some of the assumptions that the document makes raises eyebrows, like that the employee will have a second job. That implies McDonald's is admitting it doesn't pay a living wage. Or the estimate of $20 a month on health insurance. People, if you find a policy for that price, please let us know. According to the Wall Street Journal in 2010, McDonald's was charging its own employees $14 a week as a contribution to their insurance premiums. But since, as WNYC's Cindy Rodriguez reported earlier this month, one of New York's fastest growing job sectors is food service, with its often minimum wage jobs, and with housing prices notoriously high around here, there are a lot of us trying to make those two ends meet. So how do you do it? Are you living on a minimum or near minimum hourly wage right now? Call us with your strategies. What do you really spend for housing? 212-433-WNYC. What do you really spend for gas or other transportation? 212-433-9692. How do you place caps? What maximums you're willing to spend if you're living the minimum wage life? 212-433-9692. And how many jobs do you have? Call in. Let's share advice or ask for advice. And I say ask for advice because we're joined now by Deyanira Del Rio, co-director of the New Economy Project. That's the new name for the Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project, or NEDAP, who we've spoken with many times. NEDAP specialized, and now the New Economy Project specializes in financial advice for low-income New Yorkers. So, Deyanira, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me again.
What was your impression of the McDonald's sample budget as calls are coming in? It's taken a lot of criticism, but some people are saying, hey, look, it's got some good advice.
Yeah. I think in our world, when people saw this sort of the so-called McBudget, the reaction was that it was rather unfortunate. That it looked like almost a parody based on some of the, figures they put in that you just cited. What's helpful about it, actually, is that it really makes the case that someone cannot survive, much less support a family, on minimum wage in New York City or in many parts of the country. So it actually bolsters a lot of work that groups like ours are doing, not only to give people financial advice, but to really advocate for better policies that create living wage and better job opportunities for people.
And for those of you who don't know the numbers, in New York, the minimum wage is going up to $9 an hour in 2015 under recent state legislation. But it is currently the federally mandated $7.25 an hour, that's all, which works out to $13,195 a year if you work 35 hours a week all year. You can be a full-time employee and just make $13,000 a year. So McDonald's suggests getting a second job to bring your monthly income up to $2,060. Is that something that you at the New Economy Project recommend for your minimum wage workers? You're already working full-time. You're only making $13,000. You're working full-time, but you're in poverty. Go get a second job.
Yeah, so we do a lot of work with low-income New Yorkers on financial justice issues. We also work with a lot of labor groups in the city. And what we've seen collectively with our allies and at our organization is that it's unfortunately the reality for a growing number of workers that do have to take on second jobs. There is, something that the McDonald's budget and the controversy around that doesn't address is something that we've seen a lot of in New York City, and groups that work and represent low-wage workers and organize low-wage workers around the city have put a lot of information out about how it's not just low wages that workers are contending with, but also compounding those low wages are that many workers who want to work full-time can't, that they're essentially forced into part-time work. Between 2006 and 2010 nationally, the number of those people who want to work full-time and are forced to work part-time has doubled nationally. And yet another challenge that workers face is that they don't have consistent schedules. So Retail Action Project in New York City is one of the groups that's really called attention to this issue. So when you compound the low wages, the part-time work, that's already hard to make ends meet. You also have that people don't have a consistent schedule that they can plan around. And also it makes it hard to get even the second job that McDonald's recommends when you basically have to call in the same day to find out if you're working, when you don't know until that week how many hours you're going to work. And you literally have, you know, thousands of workers that work 6 hours one week, 15 the next, and so on. It's pretty hard to budget or do any planning around that, and certainly to make ends meet.
Forbes magazine, of all places, had an interesting profile of one McDonald's employee who was exactly in that category, a woman who in the Atlanta area, I think, who they interviewed, who was making her living from McDonald's, but she could never get more than about 27 hours a week out of them. And she never knew whether it was going to be as low as 20 or as high as 27. And when she was asked how she knows when she's going to work, she says, well, they post the schedule every week, and I just have to see when I'm on the schedule, which I guess, as you point out, makes it difficult for her to schedule other kinds of work around that, because if she's not available when she's scheduled, she's at risk for losing her job. But another thing that that woman said was that food stamps were an incredibly central part of getting by for her and her four kids. This was a single mom with four kids. And so her take-home pay from McDonald's was an average of about $500 a week, she said. And her food stamps, I'm sorry, $500 a month from McDonald's, $500 a month. And her food stamps are about $500 a month. And again, that's it's that high because she's a family of five. You must recommend that people take full advantage of whatever benefits are available to them from the government when they're working full time and still earning a poverty wage.
Yeah, absolutely. People should definitely get screened for eligibility with a range of benefits, including food stamps and Medicaid, that unfortunately many retail and fast food workers and restaurant workers have to rely on. It is this great irony. You have McDonald's workers and other workers in fast food as well as restaurants that essentially have to get food stamps to feed themselves and their families. You know, and it's another way that the public subsidizes these low-wage employers.
I read, and I should know this number, but the mysterious McDonald's $20 a month for health insurance in their minimum wage workers' hypothetical budget, maybe that's a Medicaid contribution. Could that just be, the individual Medicaid recipient's contribution to co-pays or something like that? Could that be the source of $20?
I don't know. I read an article that suggested it was cab fare to the emergency room when things get really dire.
Let's take a phone call. Enrique in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you? Hello.
Thank you for calling. Are you calling to give advice or
taking my call,
or ask for advice?
Okay, what I want to say is that, look, people making actually a minimum wage is $290 actually per week. And if they work actually 40 hours, if they work overtime, that would be around $340, something like this, depending how many hours of overtime they work. But, look, at the end of the month, they actually have to pay minimum $1,000 rent. I personally rent a room that have only one kitchen, one bathroom. And it was standing in the studio in a very affordable place, and I actually ended up paying actually almost $1,300. And I personally computed myself. Let's say if I had actually been making the minimum wage, at the end of the month, I have nothing actually to eat, nothing to move, nothing for the transportation. I still don't know how employees who are making the minimum wage in the state of New York actually are still alive or have a time, even money for transportation and all the things and obligations that they have toward the government and the state by itself. It's so difficult. I believe it's even below the poverty line that many, you know, politicians and government officials actually talk about.
Right. And, of course, the poverty line is a national number, and it doesn't take into account that the cost of living is higher in places like New York than some other places. Right, Dayanara? And is there any advice you would give Enrico? It sounds like he's working a little above minimum wage. He's rented a really little apartment, and yet he's still having trouble paying for food, he says.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that people overlook, you know, when we think about, okay, just help low-income people, low-wage workers budget better. You know, the reality is if you are surviving in whatever shape and form in New York City on a minimum wage or anywhere near that, you're already doing a pretty good job budgeting, right? So people have already, by necessity, acquired some skills in learning how to really cut costs, sometimes to the bare bones and at great sacrifice to themselves and their families. You know, one of the things that I want to talk about are some of the how to avoid some of the financial drains that many people experience on their income, both in the workplace and outside, and how to avoid those and navigate your way to some good resources in New York City. So to start, I would just say that, you know, one thing that we see is that financial costs, so cashing your paycheck, or, you know, having a bank account that's is full of high and hidden fees, is another way that actually a lot of low-wage workers lose large percentages of their wages. And so one thing that people can do to better control and protect the money that they do have is to put it in a savings or checking account at a local community development credit union, for example. And there's lots of them around New York City. These are not-for-profit banking institutions. And there you know that your money is safe and you have free access to your wages. One other thing that McDonald's put on their website around this, they actually have a section on that same website about their pay cards. Different McDonald's companies and franchises actually offer payroll cards to workers. So there are these plastic cards on which they deposit workers' wages. A McDonald's franchise in Pennsylvania was just sued and they got national coverage by an employer for forcing her to get paid on one of these cards, which nickel and dimed workers that get it. And so avoiding
because
those
pay cards.
Because there are
fees in cashing it out?
There are fees every time you use the card in some cases and fees to, you know, for inactivity. There's just a whole range of fees that can add up to serious deductions that actually push people below the minimum wage. So we would say to stay away from high-cost products like that.
Jilna in Port Washington, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. What's your story?
My story is never mind minimum wage. I was making $12 an hour working for Chase part-time with two children. I had great benefits. I wanted to keep my job, but I couldn't because of child care. They just, every week, they have no sympathy for workers. They just give you different schedules every week. And it's very hard for somebody to keep those kind of hours, never mind have a second job.
Did you talk to them about it?
It was a constant battle. It was during the financial crisis. I used to go home crying. It was very, very painful. I wanted to keep my job. Thank God I could afford to leave it and not be homeless. But I feel for the people that need to live like that. Having kids.
What do you do now?
Thank God my husband, you know, I really was pretty much working because of the benefits,
yes,
like health insurance. And thank God I can afford not to work. But I really feel pain for the people, mm-hmm, that really have to struggle,
yes,
every day planning childcare and having to put up with this kind,
right,
of schedules.
Thank you so much. And that's exactly what you were talking about before. Mm-hmm. I guess she's lucky enough that her husband makes enough money that she can stay home with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody is that lucky.
Yeah, and we see that some of these problems, they're not just limited to retail and fast food industries, right? So
she was working for a bank, she, yeah, said Chase, and only making $12 an hour and being on that treadmill. Let's take one more, and then we're going to be out of time. Well, actually, you know what I'll do? I'll read from our webpage because a lot of people are posting their stories and advice, too. Penny in Lower Manhattan says, join a nearby community garden. You and your family can get outside without paying a cent or traveling and maybe grow some vegetables. Somebody in Nassau County writes about an exercise that she does with her students at Nassau Community College on what the minimum wage should be to account for cost changes since 1970. For the gallon of gas, minimum wage should be $15.86 an hour. to go up as much as gasoline has. And John A. posts some advice: learn to cook, never buy processed or fast foods, never carry debt, always pay those bills first, or better yet, don't even start a debt. And he says McDonald's has at least one bit of good advice in their publication for the workers: track all your expenses for 1 month, then start adding some put-aside money, but only for emergencies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's an exercise that, you know, we in groups around the city and country have done also with people. So tracking your spending, finding, you know, it's a way for people to identify areas where they're spending more money than they realize. Certainly, there's different approaches to do that that can be sort of more or less offensive. I would also just add that, you know, people in New York City can definitely get benefit screening. So find out if you're eligible, you and your family, for different benefits that can supplement and really maximize your income. Many people are entitled to benefits and don't claim them. So there are, for example, single stops around the city where you can get that assistance. And New York City has also funded what are called financial empowerment centers throughout the city that provide free one-on-one financial counseling, can help you go through your budget, create a more realistic budget, and you can find those agencies by calling 311.
So, folks, there's some advice for minimum wage nation, fast food nation, in addition to what McDonald's offered to its employees, from Deyanira Del Rio, co-director of the New Economy Project. And by the way, here's a tweet that just came in from a listener. Tip for minimum wage workers: lobby your congressperson.
Yep.
Vote. Make your voice heard. Deyanira, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.